From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
This week, the U.S. has said the coalition attack on Syrian troops was an accident. Do you accept their explanation?
That was Ian Phillips, Vice President for International News of the Associated Press, asking Syria's President Bashar al-Assad about last weekend's U.S. attack on his country's military.
No, it's not, because it wasn't an accident by one airplane It was four airplanes that kept attacking the position of the Syrian troops for nearly 1 hour, or a little bit more than 1 hour. You don't commit a mistake for more than 1 hour. This first. Second, you're not they weren't attacking a building in a quartier. They were attacking a huge place constituted of many hills, and there was no terrorist adjacent to the Syrian troops there. At the same time, the ISIS troops or the ISIS militants attacked right away after the American strike. How could they know that the Americans are going to attack that position in order to gather the militants to attack right away and to capture it 1 hour after the strike? So it was definitely intentional, not unintentional, as they claimed.
After 15 years of wars, a new poll shows that a majority of U.S. service members are deeply skeptical about America's foreign interventions. In their opinion, the U.S. should focus on homeland defense and jobs instead of invading and, quote, stabilizing, close quote, countries like Afghanistan or Iraq. According to the poll by Military Times and Syracuse University's Institute for Veterans and Military Families, most active duty members of the U.S. military would prefer that the government refrain from overseas missions involving so-called nation building. The survey, described by the Military Times as the first of its kind, included a question, quote, how do you view the U.S. government's continued involvement in nation building efforts, establishing democracies in the Middle East and North Africa using U.S. military and financial support, closed quote. About 55% of service members said they strongly oppose or somewhat oppose those efforts, while 23% support them. The remaining 22% were either unsure or had no opinion. The majority of U.S. service members surveyed by Military Times and the Syracuse University Veterans Unit believe that the U.S. government should be more involved in combating terrorism, 62%, homeland defense, 68%, cybersecurity, 81%, and nuclear deterrence, 51%. For more on that, we spoke with our regular political consultant, Professor Anthony Montero, from Philadelphia via Skype Friday. This is quite a remarkable poll by the Military Times and Syracuse University.
Oh, yes, it is. It is very important, because what it shows is that the active military is opposed to the policies of the Obama administration and going forward a possible Hillary Clinton administration. The military is unwilling, at least the operational military, is unwilling to continue to fight these wars that have no end. And so this poll is showing that the active and operational military is against endless war, which had no direction or no military purpose. This is huge, again, because it might reflect what many people have been talking about for some time, an internal rebellion of the operational forces against their commanders. Nothing like this has occurred since Vietnam. This is huge going into the election and beyond the election.
You know, normally when you think of a mutiny among the troops, or of the military against the civilian government, you think in terms of a military that wants to take a more aggressive posture than the civilian government. But we have exactly the opposite here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think, if I might disagree with you, in history, it is usually the opposite. You know, the Russian Revolution,
for sure,
the troops rebelled against fighting anymore.
Right.
And that was the case across Europe. And in fact, many argue that the reason World War One ended is because of the fear of the various governments of Europe, the warring nations, that the troops would rebel and call for revolution. In Vietnam, it was the same thing. So I think the troops reflect the attitude of the people in general, especially when you have this volunteer army where people think they're making a profession for themselves, where there are no jobs and no professions and no education. They I think, more closely reflect the working class sentiment of weariness with endless war and such. So I think this is more the case than the opposite. The troops usually rebel for peace and against more war than the opposite.
And there's a class character to that, of course, because the troops are generally working class and the officers, particularly the policymakers, are not, usually.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And we see it now. The Central Command is so closely connected to the ruling class and carries out policies that are in the interest of the ruling class. And by that, we mean the financial oligarchy, the 1%, the 1/10 of 1%. And the troops, as you say, are working class. So here you have, in actuality, a instance of the class conflict within the military.
And I think this could very well create a severe political problem for the Clinton campaign. As you recall, when we were at the two conventions, at the Republican convention, Trump called for an end to exactly these things that the military seems to be calling for an end to: the aggression, regime change, nation building, to wide standing ovation applause from the Republican assembled Republican constituency. And then you had the barking generals of the, you know, the elite military at the DNC, who had the Clinton people behind it. And as Trump has called for peace and negotiations with Russia and China and an end to these kinds of wars, she has been, you know, the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party in general has been saying things like it would be Christmas in the Kremlin for a Trump victory because of that. But with the rank and file standing on the same turf as Trump, it's kind of hard for them to attack our troops, who have a sacred place in the political lexicon.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you, Don, and I would just add to what you're saying, and this is what we have been saying over the months, that put aside the obnoxiousness and the distasteful characteristics of the man himself, look more at the policy. And his policies reflect more the sentiments of ordinary working people. And his position on war and peace is not just driven by what's in his head or a few advisors, but is driven by his ability, quite uncanny, to sense the anti-war sentiments of ordinary people, including, and this is, again, one of the great ambiguities of this time, or perhaps ambiguity, perhaps not, reflecting the sentiments of white working and poor people, those that Clinton called the despicables, those that have been dismissed by most of the left as racist, as xenophobic, and, you know, so on and so forth. All of that aside, what does it mean if they harbor those sentiments of racism and xenophobia, but at the same time take a position against war? I mean, it seems to me that in the equation, the anti-war sentiment has a tendency to trump those other backward tendencies in the consciousness of large swaths of the white working people. And in that sense, from a political, tactical, and strategic standpoint, the left and progressive forces go with what are the progressive sentiments, highlight them, try to build upon them. You go with that rather than what we would consider historical and historically evolved backward position.
This week saw heads of state from more than 180 nations gather in New York City for the 71st General Assembly of the United Nations. Among those taking part in the annual debate was the Foreign Minister of China, Li Keqiang. This is his presentation to the General Assembly in its entirety.
Dear colleagues, the UN Sustainable Development Summit last year adopted the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, which opened a new vision for global development. At the summit, Chinese President Xi Jinping gave a speech entitled "Towards Win-Win Partnership for Sustainable Development." And right here, he expounded on China's principles and positions. And this year is the first year of the implementation of that agenda. This year's general debate is the Sustainable Development Goals, a universal push to transform our world, cannot be more relevant. On behalf of the Chinese government, here I want to state that in advancing sustainable development agenda, China has taken actions. We are the first, or one of the first, to submit to the United Nations the national plan on the implementation of the agenda. Sustainable development is first and foremost about development, and development underpins every human achievement. Without development, nothing can be sustainable. The lack of development is often at the root of many of the world's problems, be it poverty or the refugee crisis, war, conflicts, or terrorism. They all could be attributed to insufficient development, and none of them can be resolved properly without development. Only development can guarantee people's fundamental rights and interests. Only development can root out the causes for global challenges. And only development can advance human civilization and progress. Of course, development must be sustainable. It must be sustainable in all dimensions. Otherwise, development will be stalled, growth will be stalled and held back. Development won't be sustainable if it is imbalanced, unequal, and widens the gap between the North and the South and the rich and the poor. Development won't be sustainable if it is extensive, driven by high consumption, high pollution, and high emissions, and depletes resources and strains the environment. development won't be sustainable if economic growth and social progress are not well coordinated. Only when we keep a profound understanding of the implication of sustainability make all-round progress in poverty reduction, North-South and South-South cooperation, and climate change, and many other fronts, and promote equal sharing and green development, can we ensure that development will hold the ground and be sustainable? Sustainable development must be inclusive and interconnected. Currently, sustainable development endeavor is faced with great challenges. Regional conflicts and hotspots are incessant. Traditional and non-traditional security threats intertwine. And the environment for sustainable development gives no reason for optimism. World economic recovery remains lukewarm. Economic globalization faces strong headwind. And the momentum for sustainable development is weak. And there's frequent occurrence of major infectious diseases and natural disasters. And there's the issue of energy and resource security, food security, and financial security become intertwined. And sustainable development faces an uphill battle. Difficult moments call for stronger confidence. Mankind has the wisdom and the ability to find a way out. For that to happen, there must be cooperation and a spirit of working together to tide over difficulties. It is time that the international community take on a new perspective, see itself as a community of shared future and interconnected interests, and make concerted efforts to tackle global challenges. Mr. President, colleagues, to advance sustainable development, we must keep both short-term and long-term interests in mind and make concrete efforts to tackle challenges, and actively transform and change our world and to achieve our new vision. We are ready to, and we must uphold the purposes and principles of the UN Charter. Without peace and stability, there will be no sustainable development. Even the fruits already earned risk being lost. The hard-won peace that has prevailed over the past 70 years or more testifies to the effectiveness of the international order and norms of international relations based on the UN Charter. These norms and order must be resolutely upheld. This serves the common interest of people of all countries and provides the most essential guarantee for achieving sustainable development. All countries need to observe the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, support the leading role of the UN and Security Council in global affairs, support reforming and improving global governance mechanisms to reflect the changes in international political and economic landscape. A new concept of common, comprehensive, cooperative, and sustainable security should be nurtured, and a global partnership should be established that features dialogue instead of confrontation and partnership instead of alliance. We must pursue political solution to hotspot issues. Political solution is the fundamental way out. History has shown once and again that to repress violence with force can only lead to more hatred and warfare, from which no winner will emerge. Parties involved in conflicts must renounce the zero-sum mentality, settle dispute through dialogue, address differences through consultation, and seek reconciliation with tolerance. The mediation efforts of the international community must be fair and impartial. It should only facilitate the settlement of issues, not invite new problems. On Syria, we must remain committed to political solution. The international community should encourage all relevant parties in Syria to end fighting at an early date and reach comprehensive political solution. On the Korean nuclear issue, we should remain committed to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, uphold peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula, and seek consultation and dialogue-based solution so as to maintain international nuclear non-proliferation regime. Terrorism is the common enemy of mankind and must be combated resolutely. At the same time, double standards should not be applied and terrorism should not be linked with certain countries, races, or religions. We must work together for the safe, steady recovery of the world economy. The world economy cannot afford long-term sluggishness as we see now. Otherwise, sustainable development will be fountain without origin. The current world economy is faced with both insufficient aggregate demand and prominent structural conflicts. We need to employ various kinds of effective policy instruments in a holistic manner and combine demand management with supply-side reform and short-term policies with long-term policies. We call on all countries to make concerted efforts to drive the global economy along a road of strong, sustainable, balanced, and inclusive growth. Given their significant influence, major economies need to conduct responsible policymaking and coordinate macroeconomic policies. While considering their own growth, they also need to strive to reduce negative spillovers and refrain from adding to the weakness of global economic recovery. Economic globalization, represented by trade and investment liberalization and facilitation, has been an important driving force behind the fast global growth in past decades. Still, there exists no panacea in the world. Frankly, globalization has taken its toll on some industries and communities of certain countries to a certain extent. Active measures need to be taken to address the problem, but it is always important to keep in mind the bigger picture instead of having our eyes on the smaller factors only. Globalization is in line with the long-term and fundamental interest of all countries. Countries need to firmly oppose protectionism of all forms, firmly uphold the open trade regime represented by WTO, and promote the sustained and sound development of economic globalization with win-win and all-win cooperation. We must redouble efforts to address global challenges facing mankind. Greater attention and more support should be given to Africa and the LDCs to help them speed up industrialization, ensure food security, and eliminate poverty and hunger so that more people will lead a life of decency and dignity. More needs to be done to create an international environment that helps reduce inequality and imbalance in global development. International institutions should spend their new resources on developing countries on a priority basis. Developed countries should make good on their ODA commitments. And developing countries need to pursue self-development and find paths suited to their national conditions. As we speak, the world is facing the largest ever refugee crisis since World War II. It is imperative to ensure access to basic living conditions by the refugees to stave off humanitarian crisis. A more fundamental solution lies in rooting out the causes of warfare and renew development, so that source countries can be on a path toward enduring peace, development, and prosperity. Countries need to stay committed to common but differentiated responsibilities, equity, and respective capabilities, jointly tackle climate change, and work for the Paris Agreement to be accepted universally and take effect at an early date. Developed countries need to play a leading role, deliver on their emission promises and emission reduction promises, and help developing countries improve their capability on mitigation and adaptation.
Mr. President, dear colleagues, since China adopted the reform and opening up policy, the Chinese economy has maintained rapid growth, becoming the world's second largest economy in 2010. In 2014, the Chinese economy reached the level of $10 trillion. In recent years, despite a greater basis of measurement for development, overall global complexity, and long accumulated domestic underlying issues, China has relied on reform and innovation to maintain a medium-high growth rate and accelerated reform, transformation, and upgrading. In the first half of this year, the growth rate was 6.7%, among the fastest in major economies, and over 13 million urban jobs were added every year. In the first 8 months of this year, $9.5 million new urban jobs were created, Every 1 percentage point of growth now equals several percentage points of growth before, and the yearly economic increment is tantamount to the economic aggregate of a middle-income country. Running China's own affairs well is the biggest contribution to the world, and China now still contributes around 30% to world economic growth. However, we are soberly minded that China remains a developing country, and there is still a long way to go before China achieves modernization. We should continue to give top priority to development and pursue comprehensive social and economic growth, maintain medium-high-speed economic growth, and move to the medium-high level of development. China will continue to promote development through deepening reform. Reform held the key to our previous achievements in development, and the same will be true for the future. We will promote development through expanding opening up. China's experience in the past decades has proven that a closed-door policy only leads to stagnation and backwardness, and opening up brings development and prosperity. China will be firm in pursuing the win-win strategy of opening up. China will open its door even wider to the outside world. China will promote development through upholding peace. The prolonged war sufferings have made the Chinese people cherish peace even more. With a firm commitment to the peaceful path of the path of peaceful development, China will pursue friendship and cooperation with all countries on the basis of the five principles of peaceful coexistence. We uphold mutual respect among all countries in disregard of their size. China also maintains that disputes concerning territory and maritime rights and interests should be resolved through dialogue and negotiation. We need to expand the common ground while shelving differences and make continuous contribution to regional peace and stability. China has all along worked for the peaceful settlement of hotspot issues. And at the UN meetings this time, China has made it clear that we will provide $300 million of humanitarian assistance to relevant countries and international organizations. And also for other underdeveloped and the least developed countries, China will continue to provide assistance on all fronts. China is a developing country with 1.3 billion population. We need to run our own affairs well, and at the same time, we need to undertake our due international responsibility. By the end of 2015, China had provided a total of over 400 billion RMB yuan to 166 countries and international and regional organizations, and provided training to over 12 million talents in various sectors from other developing countries. Going forward, China will strengthen cooperation with other developing countries and do whatever is possible to help African countries and the LDCs. China will only increase its support and assistance to other countries as our economy grows. We stand ready to work with all countries to achieve common development and prosperity, to support sustainable development and international cooperation in relevant fields. China will increase its annual contributions to UN development agencies by $100 million by 2020 over the 2015 level. China is a country that honors its words with actions. We will translate our commitment into real actions. Mr. President, dear colleagues, it is our common task to achieve sustainable development, to transform and change our world, and to make the world a better place is the shared aspiration of all of us. China stands ready to work with the other members of the international community to build a world free from want and a world of development and dignity. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.